Podcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Welcome to the second installment of Brew Crime's Powerful Women with Powerful Podcasts January miniseries. Today's episode welcomes Cause of Death. Cause of Death explores past pandemics, epidemics, and outbreaks. Jackie discusses infectious disease and social disease, the reactions to them, the politics behind them, and the effects they have on society. I truly wish more folks would cover these parts of history to better understand what is happening presently around the world. The research is so sound, it should win a Grammy. The episode today is called Crippled Generation, the story of poliovirus. This story is a long one, but Cause of Death does a full history of the disease from its beginning, along with a personal story from Jackie's aunt, Dorothy Williams, who contracted polio as a child. Now pouring, Cause of Death. Listen up and learn a lot.
Cause of Death portrays imagery of death, war, and destruction. It may not be suitable for children under the age of 13. Hello, and welcome to Cause of Death. I'm your host, Jackie Moranti. Cause of Death is now a proud member of the Darkcast Network. If you're planning to do a podcast that addresses the darker side of life, come join us. I have my first Patreon shout-out. Thank you so much, Claire Taylor, for becoming a patron. Claire is one of my dearest friends, and she was a supporter of the show before it was a show. Maybe show influencer is the correct term. Either way, Claire, you're awesome. Thank you so much. You can find me on the Facebook group, the Facebook page, and the Instagram at Cause of Death. My Twitter feed is at Cause of Death 10. If you have questions, please DM me at any one of those places or all of them. I'll always answer questions, but sometimes I miss things. So if you don't hear from me in a few hours, bug me again. I now have a Linktree account, so for those of you who would love to rate and review, there are links to my iTunes, my Podchaser, and my Listen Notes. You can review on any one of those, or if you like to cheat, all three. My Linktree address is linktree, linktr.ee/causeofdeathpod. Don't forget to rate, subscribe, and review on iTunes or on Podchaser. Most of all, share those episodes. Word of mouth is my best advertisement. If you'd like to donate, you can do so at patreon.com/Jackie Moranti. On Patreon, you can support the show for as little as $1 a month, and all levels get ad-free content, with higher levels getting other perks. You can also buy me a coffee at ko-fi.com/causeofdeathluckycharmsunplug. You can get merch at tpublic.com/causeofdeath/luckycharmsunplugged. I have a couple of new designs up there. Go check it out. Donations support the show in a plethora of ways. It helps buy new equipment, it buys white papers and books for research, and sometimes it actually does buy me coffee to get me through long nights of research and editing. This episode marks the beginning of a new season of Cause of Death. I'm calling this season the Perfectly Avoidables. All the diseases I talk about this season will be historical accounts of the diseases themselves, their effect on society, the research that went into preventing them, the problems that were incurred during the research, the failures, the successes, and the aftermath of those successes. I'm a research scientist, so I know what goes into making a successful vaccine. Sometimes the reality is a little rough to hear, but I don't feel that I can spare details. These episodes will talk about how research was done in the past, and some of it was very distasteful. I'll talk about using various species of animals, which are still used today. I'll also talk about using corpses, aborted human fetuses, experiments on children, prisoners, and the mentally ill. None of these experimental procedures are allowed today. If you're sensitive to any of these acts, please take care of yourself and wait until the next episode to listen to the show. The Nuremberg Code was adopted by the United Nations in 1966. It wasn't truly enforced until 1976. This code made it illegal to do any kind of medical experiments on people without their express written consent. The Nuremberg Code was written in response to the atrocities performed by the Nazis during World War II, but it wasn't accepted into law until 20 years later. The lack of enforcement of the code allowed the human experimentation by government entities across the world until its enforcement in 1976. This episode is dedicated to my aunt, Dorothy Williams. She became stricken with polio as a child of 7 or 8 after falling into an irrigation ditch in Brush, Colorado. I can't be sure of the year. I don't remember. I didn't know my aunt before she had polio, but my mother would tell me that my grandparents, who were migrant farm workers from Russia, had to move from Brush to Denver so that they could be closer to Children's Hospital in order for my aunt to receive treatment. Her treatment consisted of several surgeries to repair her legs. She wore leg braces her entire life and walked with either crutches or a cane. At one point, I recall my mother telling me that she was on an iron lung for a while because she couldn't breathe on her own. Somehow, she managed to survive and was released from the iron lung. But for the rest of her life, she would have to undergo breathing treatments. The disease affected her body, but it didn't affect who she was. She graduated high school. She held a job for a while. Then, as a sign of the times, she got married and raised 2 children, a son and a daughter. She always kept a very nice home. Her yard was adorned with flowers and fruit trees that she mostly tended on her own. She loved to quilt. She made the most amazing quilts. I wish I had one of the ones that she made. She was a beautiful woman, inside and out. She passed away from lung cancer with brain metastases in 1998. She and my mother passed away of exactly the same cancer about 6 months apart. They were very close. This episode is very personal for me. Polio is a horrible disease. It's a disease that has ravaged the world for centuries and still ravages parts of the world. The efforts to eradicate polio have been heroic, but it's not over yet. I'll get to that, but first, let's start with etiology and pathology. Poliovirus is a human enterovirus that belongs to the family Picornaviridae, species Enterovirus C. It's a single-stranded RNA virus of positive polarity and a non-envelope capsid that comprises 60 copies of each of 4 capsid proteins, VP1, VP2, VP3, and VP4. The structure has depressions called canyons on the surface, which are attachment sites for poliovirus. The genome functions as mRNA in the cytoplasm of infected cells. The translation process begins with the entry of viral ribosomes into the internal ribosome entry site of the host within the 5' non-coding sequence of the RNA. This allows viral mRNA proteins to translate into host RNA from an open reading frame. The virus replicates from there. The name poliomyelitis comes from the Greek word polio, meaning gray, and myelon, meaning marrow. Humans are the only host of poliovirus. Poliovirus spreads rapidly in areas with poor sanitation and will be seen mostly in the summer months in temperate regions. It's seen year-round in tropical regions. It can be spread by asymptomatic carriers as well as those who are in the incubatory stage of the disease before symptoms present. Poliovirus infects people through the oral-fecal route. Once ingested, the virus will multiply in the alimentary mucosa and possibly the tonsils and pears patches. It then moves through the bloodstream and invades the central nervous system. There are two possible routes that the virus can take to enter the central nervous system. One is permeation through the blood-brain barrier, and the other is through the peripheral nerves. Neuronal destruction occurs by lytic replication of the virus. This causes paralytic poliomyelitis. Poliovirus is classified into three stable serotypes, types 1, 2, and 3. All three of the serotypes can cause poliomyelitis. Wild type 1 poliovirus is the cause of the world's paralytic polio cases. Wild types 2 and 3 are considered to be eradicated as of 2015. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Polio can range in severity from a self-limiting disease to meningitis. It may also present as acute flaccid paralysis. It has the potential to damage motor neurons, leading to a lifetime of muscular dysfunction or death if respiratory function is affected. Symptoms include headaches, muscle pain, fatigue, nausea, stiffness of the neck, sore throat, and muscle weakness or motor deficit. About 95% of poliovirus infections remain non-paralytic. In those that do become paralytic, severe muscle spasms with severe muscle pain is typically present before asymmetrical flaccid paralysis occurs. This paralysis tends to be predominant in the lower limbs. Only supportive care is available. There are no approved antivirals for treatment of poliovirus. Surgical intervention is often needed to restore balance in the muscles around the joints to prevent deformities. The aim is to get the patient walking again and correct factors that will lead to deformity as the patient ages. In the acute stage, supportive care is focused on reducing fever and irritation, preventing respiratory tract infections, and managing respiratory paralysis. Paralyzed legs are supported by splints to relieve pain and spasm. This also plays a role in minimizing the development of deformities. During the convalescent stage, light exercise programs are necessary to integrate the patient back into their communities. Approximately 30 to 40% of polio patients will develop post-polio syndrome decades after the primary infection. Factors depend on the severity of acute paralysis, age of onset, and socioeconomic status. Complications of post-polio syndrome include muscle pain, respiratory distress, joint pain, atrophy, dysphagia, and fatigue. These complications can lead to respiratory failure, idiopathic bone fractures, and failure to thrive. Now let's get on to the history. Polio has been around for centuries. Egyptian paintings from the period 1403 to 1365 BC depict children with deformed limbs walking with sticks. An English physician named Michael Underwood documented the first clinical description. He referred to polio as a, quote, debility of the lower extremities, end quote, in 1789. The contributions of physicians Jacob Hein and Carl Oscar Medin in 1840 gave polio the name Hein-Medin disease. Polio became a pandemic over the years. Millions of children and adults were affected with the disease. Polio is shown to have had about a 2% mortality rate, but the morbidity rate was about 50 to 60%. The story that I'll tell will begin in Brooklyn, New York, in the year 1916. That was the year that polio ravaged the U.S., And it was also the year that the great race to eradicate it began. It was June 6, 1916, when a report came in to the New York City Health Department that two boys, John Pomerese and Armando Succio, had both suddenly taken ill. They were reported to have had high fevers and paralysis. So began the first and one of the biggest outbreaks of polio in U.S. history. Smaller outbreaks had occurred in the late 1800s and early 1900s in Vermont, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, and Massachusetts, but nothing could compare to what was about to happen in New York City. The outbreak also sparked the greatest quest for a vaccine. 2 days later, reports came in about four more children with the same symptoms. By the end of that week, there were 33 cases. The next week saw 150, and it had spread to all five New York City boroughs. The man in charge of the New York City Health Department was named Haven Emerson. It was now up to him to control the outbreak. Emerson was sure he could get the job done through quarantine and some fairly crazy sanitary measures. He knew that polio was contagious, so quarantine was the best measure to stop the spread. He also knew that diseases, any diseases, would spread more easily in communities with inadequate plumbing and sewage. His plan was stated as, quote, "All premises housing a case of polio will be placarded and the family quarantined. The windows will be screened, the bed linen disinfected, nurses are to change their clothing immediately after tending any patient, and household pets will not be allowed in any patient's room," end quote. Thousands of children were quarantined. Since tenement dwellers didn't meet the requirements for home quarantine, such as a private toilet, separate dining areas, and a private nurse, children were taken from their homes by force. In an article from the New York Journal dated August 25, 1916, the story read, quote, "Mrs. Jenny Dasnoy of 365 64th Street, Brooklyn, is under the care of a physician today as a result of a strange experience with the infantile paralysis quarantine. Three policemen forced their way into her home, broke down the door to the bedroom, and drew their revolvers in assisting the ambulance surgeon to obtain possession of her small nephew, a paralysis suspect. The child, Cornelius Wilson, 2-year-old son of Mrs. Dasnoy's dead sister, is in the Kingston Avenue Hospital, Brooklyn, where physicians have not yet decided that he is suffering from paralysis. The policeman entered the house," Mrs. Dasnoy says, "by cutting the screen covering the window on the first floor, breaking their way into the room where Mrs. Dasnoy stood with the baby in her arms. Their revolvers were drawn," she charges. Mrs. Dasnoy's screams attracted neighbors to the house, but before they could enter, two of the policemen held her while the third pulled the child from her arms and passed him through the window to the surgeon, end quote. Sounds a lot like Soviet Russia, doesn't it, comrade? Parents began fighting back. Several notes threatening doctors, nurses, and health department workers were delivered with death threats if the police and healthcare workers continued to raid houses to take children. Haven Emerson believed incorrectly, I might add, that the epidemic started because, quote, 90 immigrant Italians under the age of 10 had moved to Brooklyn where the outbreak appeared, end quote. And that immigrants were the first to get polio because they were poor. Oh, yeah. And because they were poor, they were also dirty. It's odd that in a country full of immigrants, the U.S. can always pick out some immigrant to blame when things go sideways. But it still happens to this day. Anyway, Haven demanded that everyone fix their toilets and plumbing, bathe their children, and clean up their yards and cellars. He wanted the city to provide fresh water, which they should have been doing anyway. He wanted garbage collected every day, and he wanted people to protect themselves from flies. So, under the threat of imprisonment or fines, homeowners and janitors attempted to comply with Emerson's new sanitary code. 4 million gallons of water washed the streets, and 300 to 450 stray cats and dogs were killed daily to protect the residents of the communities from polio. And every day, it didn't work. The week of June 24, 1916, saw another 233 children affected by polio. By June 30th, Emerson changed his tactics. All children were to stay at home and have no contact with others. Public theaters were closed to children under the age of 16, and all public swimming pools were closed. By July 8th, the entire city was shut down. There were no public meetings at all. No parades, no events, nothing. The entire city was deserted. The following week saw 700 new cases and 170 deaths. On July 8th, the New York Medical Journal stated, quote, "The plague seems to have reached its height and to already be abating," end quote. That was a big nope. During the week of August 5th, there were 1,200 more cases and 370 deaths. Dr. Robert Guilfoy announced, quote, "During July, one child died from polio every 2.5 hours. By early August, it was every 26 minutes," end quote. By mid-August, polio had paralyzed 5,500 people and killed 1,500 more. Of course, the feds had to get involved. They issued a regulation that no child could leave the area of the epidemic without a certificate for interstate travel. Everyone outside of the city went into panic mode. A self-appointed citizens committee, read vigilante posse, of 500 people entered every home in the town of Huntington, Long Island, looking for suspected polio victims. Residents of Glen Cove, Long Island, threatened the health officer with death. They also threatened to burn down the hospital where several polio patients were housed. Police in Hoboken were standing guard at every entrance to the city with instructions that they were to keep anyone and everyone from entering. Two policemen forced a family of seven to turn back to Brooklyn at gunpoint. The family had given up their home to move to Hoboken. Desperation drove the residents of New York City to turn to snake oils for cures. They tried ingesting catnip, skullcap, lady's slipper, earthworm oil, blackberry brandy, not to mention the blood of frogs, snakes, and horses. A rumor spread that ox blood was a sure cure for polio, so people showed up at the slaughterhouses with buckets trying to get their fair share. Charms made of pepper, garlic, camphor, and onions were worn around the necks of children. One former state legislator sold cedarwood shavings that the children were supposed to wear around their necks to protect the child from death and prevent germs and insects from attacking the victim. Then there was the guy who sold something called Sol. It contained sassafras and alcohol. It was supposed to cure infantile paralysis. The legislator and the other guy both spent 30 days in jail for making false claims. Doctors were also desperate to save their patients. They injected adrenaline or fresh human saliva into the spinal cords of their patients. They took spinal fluid from the infected and injected it back under the skin. George Rattan, a New York physician, claimed that he had successfully saved a child by inserting a large hollow needle into his patient's back and draining the spinal fluid while simultaneously infusing large quantities of salt solution into a vein. He claimed that this technique would wash poisons out of the nervous system. The treatment killed more people than it saved and was abandoned a short time later. During the last 3 weeks of August, polio paralyzed 3,500 people and 900 more died. The average mortality rate of polio at the time was 5%. But that summer, the mortality rate skyrocketed to 27%. The number of cases finally began to decline in September of that year, and schools reopened. But by the time the epidemic was over, more than 9,000 people were paralyzed by polio, and 2,400 were dead. Most victims were under the age of 10 years old. Haven Emerson admitted defeat. He had incorrectly assumed that quarantine and better sanitation would stop the spread. He didn't know that polio was different. It was sneaky. It could be spread by people who were asymptomatic. No one in New York City knew the cause of polio. They just knew that it tore apart their way of life. But the cause of polio had been discovered in Vienna, Austria, 8 years earlier. On November 18, 1908, Carl Landsteiner performed an autopsy on a 9-year-old polio victim. He removed the child's spinal cord, ground it up, and injected it into two monkeys. One monkey became paralyzed, and the other died. When Landsteiner removed the spinal cords of the monkeys, he sliced them into thin sections and looked at them under the microscope. These spinal cords looked just like the spinal cords from the children who had died of polio. Landsteiner surmised that the cause of polio was a virus that invaded the victim's spinal cord. 3 years later, during a Swedish outbreak that paralyzed 4,000 people, Carl Kling figured out how poliovirus was spread. Kling examined hearts, lungs, spinal cords, throats, and intestines of 14 children who had died during the outbreak. He repeated Landsteiner's experiment and got the same results. The monkeys that he injected with material from the children's spinal cords paralyzed the monkeys. The repeated result was expected, but Kling also found that the fluids taken from the throats, windpipes, and intestines of the children also paralyzed the monkeys. This led him to believe that polio was spread through the saliva and intestines of the infected. Of course, he knew of the symptomatic cases, but as Kling began taking throat and saliva samples from family members of the children who had died, he found that there were asymptomatic cases. When he did his experiment on the monkeys, he found that they became paralyzed by asymptomatic carriers of the virus. This explained why the outbreak in New York City wasn't stopped by quarantining the sick. Many people who were spreading the disease showed no symptoms. Simon Flexner, who was the director of the Rockefeller Institute, made another important discovery at the same time that Carl Kling was doing his research. Flexner took serum from monkeys that were recovering from polio. He inoculated other monkeys with a mixture of serum and polio-infected spinal cords. The monkeys didn't get polio. He referred to the serum as germicidal substances. Today, they're known as antibodies. Several more outbreaks would happen before researchers made any progress in understanding polio. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was 39 years old in 1921. That summer, he was campaigning as James Cox's running mate on the Democratic ticket against Warren Harding. He was also recently dismissed as Secretary of the Navy after a mishandled sex scandal involving that branch of the military. He had gone to his family's summer home on Campobello Island for a much-needed break from politics and scandal. He had spent most of his days on the island swimming, playing tennis, hiking, and sailing. On August 10, 1921, Franklin Delano Roosevelt began to feel chilled and thought he was coming down with a cold. That night, he went to bed early so he could stay ahead of the sickness that he felt was overcoming him. The following morning, the muscles in his right knee felt weak. By afternoon, his leg wouldn't support the weight of his body. By that evening, he could no longer stand or walk. Medical teams were called, and he was diagnosed with polio. Soon, he was paralyzed from the waist down. He was determined to recover, and he tried several treatments. He would force himself to walk. He bathed in salt water. He used ultraviolet lights, positive thinking, and complete rest and deep tissue massage. None of it worked. Then he found Louis Joseph in Warm Springs, Georgia. Louis Joseph was a polio victim who claimed that after 3 summers of soaking in the hot springs at Warm Springs, he was cured of polio. FDR jumped at the chance to walk again. Within a year, FDR had bought Warm Springs, hoping that he could make it a place where polio victims could go to cure and convalesce. As he rose to political prowess as governor of New York, then president, he was becoming too busy to manage Warm Springs, so he asked his law partner for advice. Basil O'Connor was probably the guy who made the greatest strides in the development of a polio vaccine. O'Connor became Roosevelt's law partner in 1924. In 1927, when tasked with managing Warm Springs, he converted it into the Georgia Warm Springs Foundation, a nonprofit that was totally supported by grants and gifts. A year after FDR became president, on January 30, 1934, 6,000 balls were held in 4,000 cities across the U.S. to celebrate his birthday. The events raised more than $1 million for the Georgia Warm Springs Foundation under the slogan, "Dance so that others may walk." The president's birthday balls would raise $1.3 million over the following 2 years. The Warm Springs Foundation became the Infantile Paralysis Foundation in January 1938. The foundation began funding polio research. They hired Paul de Kruijf as research director. He encouraged Roosevelt to put the money into vaccine research. De Kruijf had an impressive background in microbiology and bacteriology, but he knew nothing about viruses or immunology. Furthermore, he had been out of the lab for 12 years. He knew nothing about poliovirus. His first order of business was to give children an acid nasal spray to keep poliovirus from entering the body. This failed, and in the end, several children lost their sense of smell due to the treatment. After failing to prove that hormone therapy, vitamins, and nutrition prevented polio, de Kruijf quit the foundation. The most common cause of death in polio victims was respiratory failure. Essentially, the muscles that control breathing would shut down as the disease progressed, and children would die of asphyxiation. In 1929, the iron lung was invented to prevent this phenomenon. The iron lung was a large tube-like structure that patients were laid in with only their heads exposed. The iron lung was powered by electricity and would increase pressure on the body to force air out of the lungs, then would decrease pressure, allowing air to be forced back in. Some patients, like my aunt, only had to stay on the iron lung for a short period of time, but others remained in the machine for the duration of their lives. This was the first mechanical medical ventilator. The National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis was running low on funds by 1937. Paul de Kruijf had run the coffers dry with his failed projects, and O'Connor began recruiting celebrities to help raise money for the project. Eddie Cantor, then a famous radio personality, pledged 30 seconds of airtime to raise money for the foundation. He asked that his listeners donate one dime to the White House for the fight against polio. He called this effort the March of Dimes. Within 1 year, the foundation raised $1.8 million, mostly in dimes, for the cause. Between 1938 and 1962, the March of Dimes raised $630 million. The March of Dimes Foundation set aside $70 million for research, and the rest went to hospitalization and rehabilitation of every polio sufferer in the U.S. 30 years after Simon Flexner found antibodies, researchers began to unravel more of the secrets of polio. A team of researchers at Johns Hopkins University found that poliovirus entered the body through the mouth, then moved to the intestines and the blood. They repeated Carl Kling's research and had the same results. Most people with poliovirus in their intestines and their blood didn't show symptoms. However, in as few as 1 in 150 infected people, the virus would travel from the blood to the spinal cord, where it would enter the cells in the spinal cord and replicate. As the virus replicates, it destroys the cells that it invades. This is how it causes paralysis. This was a huge discovery. If researchers could find a way to induce an antibody response to the virus while it was still in the blood, the antibodies would neutralize the virus before it got to the spinal cord. In 1932, Philadelphia saw a severe polio outbreak. When the outbreak was over, John Colmer put all of his efforts into making a vaccine for polio. He had tried using the same techniques that Edward Jenner, Louis Pasteur, Max Thaler, and Hugo Smith had used before him, but that was impossible. He instead used ricinylate to weaken the virus. Yeah, he used ricin. Ricin is found in the oil of the castor bean plant. It's a poison. Now it's considered a biological agent. Colmer took spinal cords from monkeys that had been infected with polio, ground them up, suspended them in a salt solution, and treated them with ricin for 15 days. He then injected his 11-year-old son, his 15-year-old son, his assistant, and 25 other children who were in a convalescent hospital. By 1934, Colmer had injected more than 10,000 children with his vaccine. Maurice Brody decided to use formaldehyde rather than use ricin in his vaccine. Brody tried his vaccine on himself and five of his co-workers. Then he proceeded to inoculate 12 other children. After taking blood from all of his subjects, he found that all had mounted the proper immune response. And since there were no adverse effects, he deemed it safe. He went on to vaccinate 7,000 children with his vaccine. In November of 1935, a meeting was held so that Brody and Colmer could present the findings of their vaccine research. The American Public Health Association held this meeting in St. Louis, Missouri. It was attended by hundreds of physicians, scientists, and public health officials. Colmer was the first to present. He told the members that since April of 1935, he had given his vaccine to 10,000 children in 36 states and Canada. However, he didn't account for a control group. There was no way to tell whether his vaccine had worked. Even worse, several children had gotten polio after receiving his vaccine. The end result was that 10 children who had received Colmer's vaccine had become paralyzed and 5 had died. Most had become paralyzed after the first dose of the vaccine, and most had become paralyzed in the arm that was inoculated. Henry Vaughn, Commissioner of Health for Detroit, said that the vaccinated child in Newark, New Jersey, was the only case of polio reported from that area during the past July. And the two children in Plainfield, Minnesota, were the only two cases of polio to die in that city. Colmer denied failure. He claimed that these cases were caused by natural polio and that his vaccine had nothing to do with it. James Leake, medical director of the Public Health Service in Washington, D.C., accused Colmer of murdering children. Colmer was humiliated, and rightly so. He had performed bad science. Maurice Brody did much better. His presentation included a control group. His data was solid. He reported that 5 of 4,500 children who were unvaccinated got polio, but 1 in 7,000 children that had been vaccinated with his vaccine got the disease. Those were much better odds. His vaccine had an 88% efficacy rate, but there was that one case. A 20-year-old vaccinated man developed paralysis in his inoculated arm and died 4 days later. 4 months later, Brody's vaccine came under fire again when two children developed polio after getting his vaccine. Both vaccines were immediately pulled. Even if his vaccine didn't work, it proved that virus treated with formaldehyde could induce an immune response in children. He was also the first to find that overtreatment with formaldehyde rendered the vaccine useless. He was also the first to claim that killed poliovirus vaccine could give lifelong protection against polio. Researchers again gave up on the idea that a vaccine against polio was possible, but research on the disease didn't stop. In the late 1930s, McFarlane Burnett and Jan McNamara, two Australian researchers, found something very disturbing. They began by injecting monkeys with the MV strain of polio. This was the same strain used by Colmer and Brody. At that time, polioviruses that had been isolated from different people were considered to be different strains. After the monkeys recovered from the initial infection, they injected them with the MV strain again. The monkeys showed immunity. This confirmed the research that had been done by several researchers prior to Burnett and McNamara. They then took the research one step further. They challenged the monkeys with the Victoria strain of polio. The monkeys were no longer protected. They got polio. This experiment showed that there was more than one type of polio. There were at least two, and inoculation with one type wouldn't give any protection against infection with another type. The bottom line was that all types had to be included in one vaccine. The problem was no one knew how many types there were. During the next 20 years, researchers would work on determining how many types of polioviruses existed. Strains were submitted from all over the world, and investigators had to check each one, then check it again to make sure that each strain fit a certain type. When they had finished compiling all of the data from every strain, they found that polio had three types. Type 1 accounted for 80% of all polio infections, and types 2 and 3 accounted for 10%. Up to this point, the science community had been using the spinal cords of monkeys to create a vaccine. However, the rabies vaccine pioneered by Louis Pasteur used spinal cords of rabbits. On very rare occasions, the rabies vaccine could cause paralysis in people due to the myelin basic protein that could cause an immune response against the nervous system. Researchers feared that the same thing would happen with a polio vaccine if the spinal cords of monkeys were used. John Enders, Thomas Weller, and Frederick Robbins solved the problem. On March 30, 1948, Thomas Weller took flesh from an aborted human fetus and put it in 12 flasks full of nutrient broth. Four of the flasks contained varicella virus, that's chickenpox. Four had poliovirus, and the last four were controls, so they contained no virus. Since polio had only been grown in tissue from the brain and the spinal column, no one thought this would work. Over the course of several weeks, Weller would remove the fluids from the flasks and inject them into mice. The mice became paralyzed. He not only found that polio grew in this fluid, but it could be diluted to one quintillion fold. That's one with 18 zeros, and still cause paralysis. When this experiment proved successful, Weller, Enders, and Robbins began using other cells to grow polio. They found that the virus would grow in human foreskin from circumcisions and kidneys. They could also use monkey kidney cells. These experiments made several things possible for the creation of a viable vaccine. First, large quantities of poliovirus could be grown in the laboratory. Prior to this, one monkey spinal cord would only produce 40 doses of poliovirus. Second, there was no more fear that the myelin from a spinal cord could cause paralysis after vaccination. Third, these researchers found that they could visualize polio through a microscope. They had observed during the experiment that cells that were exposed to poliovirus appeared gray and dead under the microscope. These three discoveries would make it possible to create an inexpensive, safe vaccine. In 1954, Enders, Weller, and Robbins became the only researchers to win a Nobel Prize in medicine for their research. By 1951, Jonas Salk had been working with the National Infantile Paralysis Foundation for 3 years, typing polioviruses, and he was ready to move forward with his vaccine research. That was the year he received a grant from the foundation to develop a polio vaccine. Between the years of 1948 and 1952, Jonas Salk and his cohort Julius Jungner developed some techniques that would lead to the first polio vaccine in 20 years that could be tested in people. They found that kidney cells worked best for growing poliovirus. One monkey kidney could make between 800 and 1,000 cultures. They knew that they would need to use all three types of polio to make a viable vaccine, so they had to choose from the various strains that they had typed over the years. Salk chose the Mahoney strain to represent type 1 polio. The Mahoney strain was the most virulent strain of polio. This strain would cause paralysis in monkeys even after being diluted to 1 to 10,000 in salt water. There were several other type 1 strains that he could have used, but he chose the most virulent one. His plan was to kill the virus before inoculating the children, but if the virus wasn't completely inactivated, he would run the risk of causing paralytic polio in children. The other strains that he used to represent type 2 and 3 were fine. Types 2 and 3 rarely caused paralysis anyway. He used the same technique as Maurice Brodie had. He treated them with formaldehyde. During the process, he injected the mixture into the brains of monkeys to see if it would cause paralysis. He found that the mixture no longer paralyzed monkeys after about 10 days of treatment with formaldehyde. In order to ensure that the virus was inactivated, he left it in the formaldehyde for another day or two. He found that the strain that took the longest time to kill was Mahoney. He then began experimenting on children at the D.T. Watson home. This was a home for, quote, destitute, poor, white female children between the ages of 3 and 16 years, especially including and preferring children crippled or deformed, end quote. Essentially, the experiments were done on throwaway children. He injected children with several different vaccines. Some children were vaccinated with either type 1, type 2, or type 3 poliovirus. Some were vaccinated with all three. Some were vaccinated with cells grown in monkey kidneys. Some were cells grown in monkey testicular cells. Some children were injected directly into the muscle. Others were injected subcutaneously. Salk had no clue which vaccine would work, which delivery route would work, or which strain would work. Over the next few months, he drew blood from the 100 children he had vaccinated. Only one of the strains, the type 2 strain, mounted any kind of antibody response. In May of 1952, Salk began vaccinating residents at the Polk State School. This school housed mentally disabled boys and men. This time he used a vaccine that contained all three types of poliovirus. He also suspended the vaccine in mineral oil and inoculated all of his subjects intramuscularly. This time he was successful. The subjects of this experiment shown to be immune to all three types of polioviruses. Mineral oil was the perfect carrier for the vaccine because it stays in the muscle for a long time, so it allows constant stimulation of the immune system and longer immunity. This experiment also proved that the vaccine was safe. None of the children that Salk had vaccinated had any signs of illness from the vaccine. He presented his findings at a meeting of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis in Hershey, Pennsylvania, on January 23, 1953. Soon after, everyone was pushing Salk to get his vaccine out to market. The media caught wind of his findings, and Salk found himself directly between a rock and a hard space. He wasn't ready to release the vaccine. That spring, he vaccinated himself, his wife, and his three children. Salk believed in his vaccine. He believed that one dose would give a child a lifetime of immunity. Then came Joseph Bell. Bell was brought in by the foundation to design the testing of the vaccine, but Bell believed that using mineral oil as a carrier wasn't safe for children. In his experience, people injected with mineral oil would sometimes develop adverse effects. He reported about painful arms and abscesses that took months to heal. So the foundation went to Salk and demanded that he use a different carrier. Salk knew that only one preparation without mineral oil had actually been successful. Between March and October of 1953, he found a method that would avoid mineral oil. He changed three things in his vaccine. The new vaccine was made using only monkey kidney cells. He diluted the virus with less formaldehyde. The dilution went from 1 to 250 to 1 to 4,000. And he used higher temperatures to inactivate the virus. He went from 33 degrees Fahrenheit to 98 degrees Fahrenheit. He tested the new vaccine on monkeys and on cells in the lab. The monkeys and the cells remained healthy. Then he created the straight line theory of inactivation. This was explained as the volume of one dose of vaccine given to children at Watson and Polk was 1 milliliter. Before treatment with formaldehyde, one dose contained about 1 million infectious particles. According to the model, treatment with formaldehyde caused the quantity of virus to decrease steadily and predictably. After treatment for 12 hours, one dose contained 100,000 infectious virus particles. After treatment for 24 hours, only 10,000 particles remained. After treatment for 72 hours, only one infectious particle remained. The quantity of infectious poliovirus had been killed by 1 millionfold in 3 days. When Salk graphed this out, the quantity of virus versus the time that the virus was treated made a straight line on the graph. According to Salk's reasoning, if the virus was treated for 3 more days and the line remained straight, then another millionfold reduction would occur. Instead of one infectious particle in one dose of vaccine, there should be one infectious particle in 1 million doses of vaccine. If the virus was treated for 3 days past that, then there would be one infectious particle in 1 trillion doses of vaccine. According to this theory, if the virus were to be treated for 9 days, the virus would be completely inactivated. The problem with this is that, at the time, there was only one part of the graph that could be tested in the laboratory. The virus preparations could be tested to 1 to 1 million particles in one dose, but it wasn't possible to test 1 million to 1 trillion. There was a point where the graph went from reality to assumption. As long as you could assume that the graph remained a straight line, things would be fine. But if the line curved back, there was a chance that the live virus might still be in the vaccine. Later in the year, two prominent researchers tried to reproduce Salk's research. They failed. They warned against using the Salk vaccine at a meeting of the American Public Health Association in New York City on November 10, 1953. Albert Milsner and Sven Gard found that the inactivation method was not a straight line. They encouraged Salk to extend the time of inactivation for the vaccine to 12 weeks. While these researchers were warning against the use of the Salk vaccine, the National Foundation had begun a large-scale trial of the vaccine. 400,000 children received the vaccine. In order to get the vaccine campaign off the ground, the foundation had to recruit several pharmaceutical companies. These companies were the only ones with the resources to make the vaccine on such a large scale. Parke Davis was the first company that the foundation approached. But before they could do anything, they needed a protocol. Salk was still fine-tuning the vaccine, so he hadn't written a protocol. Eventually, negotiations with Parke would break down. They were concerned that Salk didn't have a vaccine at all. They viewed him as unprepared and incompetent. Parke Davis did sign up to provide the vaccine for the trial, but they were on guard. They were going to make sure that they went above and beyond when making this vaccine. February of 1954 saw four more pharmas who were willing to participate in the manufacture of the Salk vaccine: Eli Lilly, Wyeth Laboratories, Pittman Moore, and Cutter Laboratories. These companies would only get paid after the trial was over. They would pay for the doses provided for the trial, then the foundation would buy 27 million doses for $9 million. The companies would win either way. If the trial failed, they wouldn't be out that much. But they'd still get paid for the doses that they couldn't use. Basil O'Connor was banking on the trial going well. The companies were ready to start manufacturing the vaccine, but Salk had still not provided a protocol. He had written a paper with his research, but he never published it. Salk's paper strictly outlined his concepts of inactivation, his straight-line theory, the importance of filtration before inactivation, and how large and small batches of polio might have different rates of inactivation. He thought that as long as the scientists at the pharmas understood his theories, that the details of manufacture wouldn't matter. To say that he was wrong is an understatement. The protocol that he presented to the pharmas was a 55-page document outlining the manufacture of the vaccine. The second appendix included a thorough description of his straight-line theory of inactivation and a recommendation that at least four samples of formaldehyde-treated virus be collected during the inactivation process. He failed to outline the type of filter that should be used, the maximum quantity of vaccine to be inactivated per batch, and the exact intervals that samples should be tested during inactivation. Basically, this left it up to the pharmas to fill in the gaps on their own. Parke Davis and Eli Lilly were the first to make vaccine for the trials. They had the most experience in making vaccines. Cutter Labs fell behind. They mostly made veterinary products and had the least experience making vaccines. Joseph Bell would be appointed to oversee the field trial. He decided that samples of every batch would be tested for safety by the manufacturer, Jonas Salk, and the National Institutes of Health. The National Institutes of Health would eventually be responsible for licensing the vaccine through the Laboratory of Biologics Control. Scientists at the Laboratory of Biologics Control mostly did research that had nothing to do with vaccines, and regulation of vaccines hadn't become a real thing yet. William Workman was the head of the Laboratory of Biologics Control. He was the first one to notice that four of the first six lots of inactivated vaccine made by Parke Davis and Eli Lilly contained live poliovirus. He wrote a letter to Salk asking that the field trial be postponed until the methods could be improved. On March 25, 1954, the field trial was cleared to begin with one condition. Companies had to make 11 consecutive lots of vaccine that passed all safety tests before their methods would be accepted. Paul de Kreef had leaked the failure of the vaccine to the press. Of course, they reported it, and 150,000 children withdrew from the trial. In the end, the trial included 420,000 children who were injected with the vaccine made by Eli Lilly and Park Davis, 200,000 children injected with saline, and 1.2 million children who were given nothing. Only the people at the foundation and the NIH knew which children were getting the vaccine and which were getting placebo. 16 unvaccinated children in the trial died from polio. 36 children developed severe polio, of which 2 had been vaccinated. On April 12, 1955, the news was announced to the entire world that the trials were a success. The event had been broadcast on television and radio, and the world rejoiced at the news. The responsibility of the safety of the vaccine transferred from the foundation to the Laboratory of Biologics Control, so they could take over licensing the pharmas to make the vaccine. No one in that position had any experience with polio, or vaccines for that matter. The heads of the National Foundation were just a bit leery of handing over control of the vaccine to the government, and with good reason. Salk had written a 55-page protocol outlining the specifications for making the vaccine, albeit with a few critical omissions. But when the government handed its protocol to the manufacturers, the document was down to 5 pages of, quote, minimum requirements. The pharmas only had to comply with the government document. The National Foundation required that the companies make at least 11 consecutive lots of vaccine that was free of live virus. But the government required a, quote, method which was consistently effective and reliable in inactivating a series of lots, end quote. Nothing was specific or defined. The Salk Protocol gave a detailed account of the concept and technique of virus inactivation. These details were omitted from the minimum requirements. Details on the number of samples to be tested and how long the treatment with formaldehyde should last were never given. Salk had required that the virus be inactivated with formaldehyde in a final concentration of 1 to 4,000. The wording in the NIH document read, if formaldehyde is to be used for inactivation. This was to accommodate the interest that Park Davis had in creating a vaccine that would be inactivated with ultraviolet light. That was only a pipe dream at the time. It had never been tested anywhere. The last flaw in the government's protocol was a statement that manufacturers were not legally required to inform the government about batches of vaccine that failed safety tests. Those batches were just not submitted for approval. The Laboratory of Biologics Control signed the licenses for the pharmas to begin production of the Salk polio vaccine at 4 o'clock p.m. on April 12, 1955. In 3 hours, they had reviewed all of the documents submitted by the 5 pharmas and the documents submitted by the National Foundation and decided to grant the licenses. Today, it takes a minimum of 1 year to license a vaccine, and that's after several years of field trials and experiments. There are very few exceptions, COVID being one of them. But as a general rule, it takes at least 12 years to get a drug to market. Qatar Laboratories had problems making consistent batches of vaccine from the beginning. They were not equipped to make a vaccine of this caliber. They were finding live virus in almost every batch that they were making. Qatar called in Julius Jungner of the foundation for advice. Jungner went to the Qatar plant and took a tour. The lab was in disarray. Live virus was being stored with inactivated virus. Protocols were sloppy. And worse, they were not getting a straight line result while they were inactivating the virus. Youngner met with Salk shortly after, asking him to write letters to William Workman at the Laboratory of Biologics Control. He wanted the Laboratory of Biologics Control to revoke Cutter's license. Salk never wrote the letters. Neither did Youngner. So nothing was done, and the problems at Cutter slipped through the cracks. On April 12th and 13th, 1955, the Laboratory of Biologics Control approved 13 lots of polio vaccine for distribution. Six were from Cutter Labs, two were from Eli Lilly, three were from Park Davis, and two were from Pittman Moore. Cutter released three more lots of vaccine between April 19th and April 21st. Over the following 2 weeks, 40 lots of vaccine containing 5 million doses were released from all five companies. On April 25th, Harold Groening, regional medical director for the Public Health Services in Chicago, called William Workman with horrifying news. 13 days after receiving their first vaccine doses, seven children were paralyzed in the limb that had been injected. All seven had received vaccine that was made by Cutter Laboratories. Meetings were held that included all major players from the NIH and the CDC to decide whether the vaccinated children had gotten natural polio or if the vaccine had caused them to get it. They knew that Salk's vaccine wasn't 100% effective after three doses, and these children had gotten the disease after the first dose. So it was possible that the children had already been infected with the disease just before getting vaccinated. They reviewed the protocols that Cutter had sent them, but Cutter had only sent protocols for the vaccine that had passed the safety tests and had been sold to the public. They didn't see the protocols for the one-third of Cutter's vaccine that had failed safety tests and been destroyed. The directors argued for several hours. Many of them wanted to recall all of Cutter's vaccine because the cases of polio were so similar. All had started at the injection site, and the children had shown symptoms within a day or so of getting vaccinated. Others wanted to wait. They thought it might be a fluke, and they didn't want to jeopardize the rollout of the vaccine. At that time, Leonard Scheel was the Surgeon General of the United States. Because the others couldn't come to a decision, it was left up to him to make the decision. He could do one of three things. He could recall the Cutter vaccine alone, he could recall all of the Salk vaccine, or he could do nothing. The biggest problem he faced was that he couldn't force Cutter to recall the vaccine. The government could license pharmas to make a drug, but they couldn't revoke the licenses. If the Cutter vaccine was to be recalled, Cutter would have to do it voluntarily. Scheel asked Cutter to recall all of its vaccine on April 27, 1955. Cutter complied and sent telegrams to all health departments and drugstores that had received its vaccine. The telegram read, quote, urgent. No further injections of Cutter polio vaccine are to be made. Immediately advise your physicians. Please return all unused supplies of poliomyelitis vaccine, end quote. By April 29th, Cutter's vaccine had claimed 11 victims. Robert Cutter, the CEO, was not ready to admit it was his vaccine that had caused the problem. Quote, retesting has already begun, Cutter said. There is only one thing to do, run down every possible clue. We cannot possibly let any of the vaccine out until we are sure. No single lot of the vaccine has been implicated, and we hope no lot, nor the vaccine, is implicated, end quote. By April 30th, Cutter's vaccine had either paralyzed or killed 25 children. Alexander Langmuir, chief epidemiologist at the CDC, was tasked with determining who had been affected by the Cutter vaccine. He was the first to use the term the Cutter incident. That term would stick, and years later, microbiology, immunology, virology, and epidemiology students would have long discussions about the causes and the effects of the Qatar incident on vaccine production. After Christmas, I'll do a More Than You Ever Wanted to Know episode on the aftermath of the Qatar incident. But for now, I'm going to just get on with the story. At that point, 300,000 children had received the Qatar vaccine in California, Idaho, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, and Hawaii. Older children and adults had received 80,000 doses in 26 states across the country. There was a surveillance system in place, so the vaccines could be tracked and so could every incidence of polio, but it was a long process. In the end, Qatar lots 19468 and 19764 were responsible for 51 cases of polio and 5 deaths in children who had received them. They also found that the disease caused by the vaccine was worse than that of natural polio. Children were more likely to be paralyzed, more likely to need breathing assistance with iron lungs, and more likely to die. It was later found that at least one-third of the children who had received the Qatar vaccine had experienced symptoms of polio. At least 120,000 doses of vaccine had gone out the door with live poliovirus. During the investigation, it was found that all of the pharmas tasked with making the new vaccine had, at one time or another, experienced problems with their inactivation method. The straight-line model wasn't working. The difference between Qatar and the others was that the safety testing was performed differently. Other pharmas were using more sensitive testing methods, but all had rejected several lots of vaccine before they were released to the public. For the most part, since the straight-line model wasn't working, the pharmas were guessing on how long it took to inactivate the virus. After reviewing the problems that all of the pharmas were having, the Surgeon General recalled all of the Salk vaccine, and the rollout was halted. 3.9 million doses were pulled from distribution on May 5, 1955. Qatar ultimately took the blame and the brunt of the lawsuits, but the stars had to align in just the right way to make them the only demons. 7 events had to happen simultaneously at Qatar laboratories for them to have failed so miserably. The first one was the use of the Mahoney strain for type 1. Salk made that choice. Salk felt that if the Mahoney strain was completely inactivated, it wouldn't pose a threat to the public. But Salk had put excess pressure on all of the pharmaceutical manufacturers by using that strain when other, less virulent strains were available. In fact, the government protocol didn't specify any strain of virus be used in the vaccine. It only specified that types 1, 2, and 3 were included in all vaccines. Mahoney is still used in polio vaccines today, but the methods for inactivation are much better, and the tests are far more sensitive. The second thing was that Qatar had picked a filtration method that wasn't consistent. Salk had recommended Seitz filters. Seitz filters were made of asbestos and were the best filtration systems at the time. Qatar was using glass filtration. Glass filters were made individually by hand and were less consistent than the Seitz filters. Seitz filters were guaranteed to remove all debris from the product, but glass filters often left a bit of debris behind. The third thing that had to happen to ensure Qatar's failure was that safety tests were inadequate. The government required 2 tests to be performed. The vaccine had to be injected into monkeys and then into monkey kidney cells. If the monkeys didn't become paralyzed and the cells didn't die in 30 days, the vaccine was considered safe. Part of Qatar's problem was the dose they were using for their safety tests. The government only required that 1 milliliter of each lot be tested. Other pharmas were using much higher doses. Sometimes up to 1 liter of each lot was tested for safety. But Cutter used the minimum requirement. It was also later found that monkeys weren't the best test system for the vaccine. Injecting monkeys wouldn't necessarily paralyze them if the doses were small enough, because monkeys don't naturally produce cortisone. People do. This was proven 2 years after the Cutter incident. The fourth star that had to align was that Cutter let filtered virus sit in the refrigerator for weeks and sometimes months before inactivating it with formaldehyde. This caused cells to form on the bottom of the flasks, making them harder to filter. Cutter was the only pharma to do this. The fifth and probably biggest and most important mistake that Cutter made was that they never constructed a graph to determine the time in which the virus should be inactivated. Cutter guessed. The fault of this step lies squarely on Cutter. The sixth thing that happened at Cutter was that they never told other researchers they were having problems. They never asked for help. They knew there were problems, but they never told anyone. The last thing that pushed Cutter to failure was that the federal government didn't know that Cutter was having a problem. Since it wasn't a requirement for pharmas to report failed lots, Cutter didn't report them. The foundation had a consistency requirement of 11 consecutive successful lots. When the government got involved, they dropped that requirement. Cutter never made 11 consecutive lots that passed safety tests. They never made 4 consecutive lots that passed safety requirements. If any one of these things hadn't have come to fruition, the Cutter incident wouldn't have happened. And while quite a few of their shortcomings are very much their own fault, they were faced with challenges that they weren't prepared to overcome. By all intents and purposes, they followed the rules that the government set down to the letter. They just didn't follow the rules that the vaccine creator set down for them. For years, there would be lawsuits and litigation against Cutter Labs. Many laws would change, and certainly things would be done differently, including a different vaccine. This incident was directly responsible for the loss of faith in the vaccine program. The entire world was terrified of any vaccine. Several outbreaks of polio would literally cripple the country without a reliable vaccine. Then came Albert Sabin. Albert Sabin was determined to make a vaccine that wasn't dependent on the inconsistencies of the inactivation of the polio virus. His vaccine was risky, but it would be the one that would take the place of the Salk vaccine for many years after the Cutter incident. Sabin's vaccine used all three types of polio that had been grown in monkey kidney or testicular cells over and over again. The virus would grow better and better in monkey cells each time, but they would be less capable of causing disease in people each time. Sabin tested his vaccine in 90 million people in Russia. 75 million of these were inoculated in 1956. Sabin's vaccine was intriguing. It would be less expensive to manufacture, and it could be given orally. Children could receive the vaccine in a sugar cube. The only reason that a sugar cube was used to administer the vaccine is so that it would taste better. It seemed like the perfect solution. But science being what it is, others had to replicate Sabin's results. And in 1957, George Dick, a professor of microbiology at the Queen's University in Belfast, did just that. His results were, well, alarming. Dick took live weakened polio virus and inoculated it into the brains of 12 monkeys. Nothing happened. The monkeys weren't paralyzed. He then took the vaccine and gave it to 170 children. He collected fecal samples from the children and injected the monkeys with the fecal matter from the children. 11 of 22 monkeys became paralyzed. The virus had regained its ability to replicate after passing through the intestinal tracts of those vaccinated. That meant that these children would be infecting others with polio. They became carriers. In 1962, the U.S. had to make a choice. Continue with the Salk vaccine or go with Sabin's vaccine. The Sabin vaccine had several features that made it way more attractive. It protected 100% of those who received the vaccine. Salk's vaccine had an 80% efficacy rate. It was much easier to make, and as I mentioned before, it would be cheaper and easier to administer. It was known to protect those who came in contact with the immunized. About 25% of people who came in contact with immunized children would develop immunity to poliovirus. That niggling problem that Dick had found was ignored. Even though the Surgeon General's office issued a statement saying Sabin's choice of type 3, quote, shows a tendency to change its ability to cause paralysis after passage in man, end quote. They urged researchers to find a superior type 3 strain. That never happened, and the U.S. went with Sabin's vaccine. On October 5th, 1964, after 100 million doses of the Sabin vaccine had been administered, a research paper appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The paper confirmed George Dick's research. Not only was Sabin's vaccine paralyzing monkeys after passing through the intestines of children, but it was paralyzing people. 57 cases of paralysis occurred after receipt of Sabin's vaccine. 36 of those were caused by type 3 poliovirus. These cases were not associated with any particular pharma or lot. The U.S. didn't pull it. Between 1964 and 1979, Sabin's vaccine was given to millions of children in the U.S. They believed that since paralysis was rare, one in every 750,000 vaccinated children, the risk was worth the reward. In 1979, the U.S. declared that natural polio had been eliminated in the U.S. However, between 1980 and 1996, 6 to 8 children who received the Sabin vaccine were paralyzed. The U.S. switched back to the Salk vaccine on October 20, 1998. The litigation over the Cutter incident would go on forever, and it would change the way vaccines are made and the attitudes of pharmaceutical companies who made them. This brings us to today. Polio has been eradicated in all parts of the world except Pakistan and Afghanistan. During 2020, efforts to eradicate polio ceased because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and cases in those countries climbed at an alarming rate. It's the way of infectious disease. One thing will push another into the background. Pakistan and Afghanistan have always had unstable governments, and that phenomena drives who gets medical treatment and who gets vaccinated and who doesn't. This will be a theme in many of the episodes this season. WHO is hopeful that polio can be eradicated in nature worldwide by March of 2023. But again, that all depends on the situation with COVID. Until we can get one thing under control, we can't control another. I'll be watching to see what happens in the next year or two, and I'll let you know. So that's it for polio. Again, I'll address the Cutter incident in more detail after the holidays. It's worth talking about because it not only affected the way that vaccines were made, but it also affected the future of vaccines and the cost. Deep breath. That was a long one. And I appreciate all of you sticking with me through it. Let's get to some Q&A. Jessica asked why there are rabies vaccines for pets, but not people. Well, there is a vaccine for rabies in people. It's actually the same vaccine that's given to pets. It's not given widely because rabies isn't an epidemic in people. But veterinarians and vet techs have to be immunized against rabies. I'll talk more about rabies in a future episode. Great question. Mallory had several questions about the Omicron variant. I thought viruses often get less deadly as they mutate. Do we even need to worry about this, or is it just media hype? If Omicron has been in the U.S. for months without being detected, isn't that actually a good thing? That means it's not a worse variant causing worse problems. Okay. I'm going to start with the less deadly as they mutate question. Virulence is variable. You have a 50-50 chance that a virus will be less virulent as it mutates. Omicron could be worse than Delta, or it could be better. The truth is, we don't know the answer this early in the game. The goal is to get on top of the thing before it becomes another smallpox. None of this is media hype. It's genuine concern. We have to stop the variants so that we can stop the virus from spreading. The media has downplayed this for 2 years, and we're working on 700,000 deaths and even more people with long-term illness. At this point, we should be taking it pretty seriously, I think. Omicron hasn't been in the U.S. for months. It reached the U.S. a few weeks ago. It began in South Africa, as far as we know, about 2 months ago, but only recently has it gotten to the U.S. The bottom line is that we have to get a grip on COVID before life can go back to normal. Our best bet is to come up with a vaccine that will guard against all of the variants, but before we can do that, we have to stop making new variants. It's quite the catch-22. Thanks for the question, Mallory. I appreciate you. JT asked, has anyone asked if people have been so insanely hesitant in the past to follow scientifically backed precautions and ways to help and keep people safe? Actually, that's the whole problem. No one has asked that question. But that's why cause of death exists. I want to help people understand that none of this is new. It's all been done before. It's why I keep referring people back to past episodes. And it's why COVID was the last thing I talked about in the first season. I wanted people to understand that we keep making the same mistakes over and over. This is actually a question that everyone should be asking. It's the most important question there is. If we don't look at the past, we can't even hope to make our future any brighter. This episode on polio was demonstrative of how things have changed in the field of research to make things more accurate. It outlines the mistakes that we made with the Salk vaccine and the successes we've had over the years. It tells of the changes we've made in research and how to make vaccines safer. This whole season, we'll talk about things like that. JT and Mike both are hosts of Brew Crimes. If you haven't listened to Brew Crimes, you should. It's a great show. My recent favorites were the episode on the Whiskey Wars and the one on the Vikings in Newfoundland and Labrador. Check it out. You'll be hooked. My friend and number one patron, Claire, asked how diseases are named. Well, there are several ways. Some of them are named after the person who discovered them. Some of them are named after the places they were discovered. In the case of polio, it was named after a phenomenon that was found at autopsy after the patient had died. The word polio means gray, and the word myelin means marrow. We'll talk more about this as we go along. It'll be a prevalent topic during this season and the moldy oldie season that's coming up. I also had an earlier conversation with Claire about mRNA vaccines and the testing behind them. Specifically, how did we manage to push a vaccine through all of the testing needed in less than a year when it normally takes 10 years at a minimum to get a vaccine through? The first thing to remember is that mRNA technology isn't new. It's been around for at least 10 years. It started with cancer research. Ugar Shaheen and his wife, Uzlem Tarisi, began researching mRNA in the early 2000s as a possible cure for cancer. They formed BioNTech in 2008. It wasn't until COVID-19 came along that they began working with Pfizer to use the technology for a vaccine against COVID. It was one of the things that was brought into play for emergency testing against the virus. Because this technology has been around for a while, we knew it was safe, so we could push it through to see if it would work as a vaccine. There were also several tests done on people and animals to make sure that the vaccine was safe and to test for efficacy. So what we did was we tested everything in tandem and then put the vaccine out because we already had all of that research from the last 10 years. All right, so that's it for this time. I'm happy to see all of the questions that are coming in. I'm also happy to see that people are listening and enjoying learning about infectious disease and history. The cockles of my heart are sufficiently warmed. Until next time, be safe, have a wonderful holiday season, and I'll see you a few days before Christmas when I bring a special episode. Thank you all for listening to Cause of Death.
Mike and I hope you enjoyed that episode of Cause of Death. If you liked her show, head over to whichever podcast service you use and hit subscribe. Rate and review the show and let her know Brew Crime sent you. Remember, you can always find us on all of the social media, for better or worse. We're there at Brew Crime. Leave a rating or a review wherever you listen and come say hi to us. You can also find us at www.brewcrime.com and on Patreon by searching Brew Crime. Don't say we didn't make it easy for you. Any money goes directly back to the show in the form of software and equipment to make the show even better. Thank you, everyone, and we will see you next week for a featured episode from the podcast Freaky as Fuck.
The Oracle Network.